Hello and welcome to Volume 140 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss how to better listen as a valuable trait in forest management. We'll talk about the value of power poles. We'll have part three in a three-part series on the carbon offset markets. And we'll discuss whether owning property is really all it's cracked up to be. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through ForesterSearch.com, or there's a link on this page. You'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Bart Wilson is a professor of economics and law at Chapman University. He's written a book called The Property Species, which explores the rather unique relationship between humans and the concept of owning property. It's one of those keystone concepts that we rarely take time to think about. Welcome, Bart.
Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Bart, how do you define property? Do people define it all the same way? And why do humans think they need to have property?
Well, depending on which department you visit at your favorite university, you're going to get very different answers to that question. If you go to humanities departments, they'll tell you that property is a modern Western European. They might throw in hegemonic and male construction. And if you go to biology departments, they'll tell you that all sorts of animals defend and possess food, mates, and territory, so they have property. I'm a social scientist, a law professor. My compromise goes down the middle, which is going to make nobody happy, and that is that all humans have property and only humans have property in things. And by that, I mean that all human groups over history have had at least property in tools, utensils, and ornaments. But over time, that has grown, and so in modern Western societies, we have property in land, we have property in ideas even. And so it's passed on. But the common theme of all human groups is that it has to be learned every generation. And so we're the only animal that will classify a thing as mine. Primatologists have good reason to believe that chimpanzees think things like, I want this, but I want this does not mean the same thing as this is mine, which every two-year-old learns with great disappointment from their parents. And so the key about property is that I have something, and then we also have to have the concept of yours. There is no mine really without thine. And so every time I make a claim that this is mine, this land is mine, this thing is mine, I'm requiring everyone else to think with the concept of yours, because I want them to say that is yours. And so property's got to be reciprocal. You have to have these relationships of, well, this is mine and that is yours. Why? Because we have these dangerous impulses to go around and want to claim other people's things and take them. And so we have this notion of property to basically create peace so that you have yours and I have mine, and we're not spending time fighting over defending those claims, and then we can actually do something productive with them.
Even within the human species on planet Earth, do you think that all humans think of property in the same way, especially real property?
So, no, and that's part of it. If it's a custom and it's getting passed down, we learn from our mentors what we know and how we understand what property is. And so it can change and vary all over the world about how you think of these claims of this is mine and what's considered right by that. And that's the big difficult problem in human relations, is settling those kind of conflicts.
Okay. Well, Bart, thank you for that. We appreciate your contribution.
Thank you for having me.
Russell Hardy is the forest manager at Clemson's Experimental Forest. He recently hosted visiting scholars and researchers from Germany, and this resulted in a learning experience for both parties. Welcome, Russell.
Well, thanks for having me.
What was the purpose of these visits with these scholars and researchers, and what did you hope to accomplish?
Well, in 2017, and again in 2019, my colleague, Dr. Patrick Eagle, and I, we led a group of students and landowners to Germany and Switzerland. Our goal then was to provide an opportunity for our students to gain a new perspective for problems in forests and land management here at home. The recent visit from the German faculty essentially served the same purpose for them.
Okay. Well, what differences, if any, did you observe in their view of forest management and your own?
Well, I think the greatest differences involve our common use of herbicides, intensive single-species management, such as lopwood pine, even-age management, and the practice of clear-cutting. We have different local economic factors. Traditional management practices are different. Laws, rules, and regulations that affect our decisions are different here and there. Over there, diverse multiple-use forests are the norm, due in part to the relative scarcity of forest land compared to the much larger U.S. European forests are largely managed as continuous cover, uneven-age forests with long-term focus on diversity for sustainability with the challenges of climate change. And they manage the forest intensively by identifying each crop tree, performing timber stand improvement, ensuring regeneration is present, you know, for the future, all within the same stand, and they do this continuously. Another difference is in Germany, wood utilization there is extremely efficient. Where here in the U.S., we tend to leave a considerable amount of biomass and residual on site. And I know we're working in many ways to try to change that. Softwood rotations there are typically 60 to 80 years, while high-quality oak veneer logs are usually managed from like 150 to 300 years. And this long-term management regime will often see the tenure of at least three, sometimes 10 or more foresters in the life of a single tree. In my short career, I've already seen trees harvested that I helped establish.
What did you learn from a human standpoint about listening to others who have differing experiences than yours?
Well, I think you start to open, you know, your eyes to seeing different possibilities. And you start to, you know, to think outside of the box. One of the ways to kind of help better understand the different viewpoints on forest management is consider taking a forestry tour. Visit another country or region that does not have the same issues or challenges that you have, because experiencing the cultural differences in other areas, that helps bring it all together. And, you know, we know there's no substitute for experience. If you understand the solutions they've developed for their problems, you'll start to think outside of the box for the solutions to your issues here at home.
Okay. All right. Well, I believe there's a tour in 2022 that could be open to forest landowners and forestry professionals that Clemson's offering, so people can get in touch with you on that, I'm sure.
That's right.
Well, thank you, Russell.
Thank you.
David Claybaugh is a professor at the University of Georgia. He's written recently about the role that power poles play in forest management. Hello, David.
Hello there. Thanks for having me.
What qualifies a pine tree as a potential pole, and how does the value of that pole compare with other products like pulpwood and saw timber?
So pine poles can come from naturally regenerated and planted stands of longleaf, slash, loblolly, or shortleaf pine. But longleaf and slash pine are often preferred. Trees must meet strict height, diameter, straightness, taper, and defect standards to qualify as poles. And well-managed stands may start producing poles by about age 30, but smaller pole products such as construction or barn poles have been documented in stands as young as age 22. Construction or barn poles are usually about 10 to 30 feet long with a 4 to 5 inch top diameter. And that's without bark. And pilings used for docks and other marine needs may be 20 to 70 feet long, and they usually have to meet stricter standards for various lengths. And so pole values will vary throughout the Southeast, but Georgia statewide pine pole values in the last 45 years have been about 3.5 times greater than pulpwood, 2 times greater than chip-n-saw, and about 1.5 times greater than saw timber. And during the period from about 2016 to 2020, pine pole stumpage prices in Georgia averaged about $45 per ton. But remember, when selling individual trees, they should be sold for their highest value. And remember that poles markets will not be the same throughout the Southeast, so work with a professional that knows local markets.
What management strategies can landowners use if they want to grow poles?
So sound and timely forest management is vital for growing poles that meet specifications to qualify as them. So stand establishment should start with good pre-plant site preparation tailored to soil and vegetation conditions. The pine species planted should be well adapted to the site. And the best quality seedlings of the chosen species, such as mass-controlled, pollinated, or varietal with loblolly pines, or second or third generation open-pollinated slash pine, should be planted on the better quality sites with higher site index values. And you should, of course, hire an experienced planting crew, and the correct planting density should be selected based on the chosen species and genetics level, as well as civic cultural inputs such as site prep and herbaceous weed control. But in general, most stands managed for poles are planted at densities of 500 to 750 trees per acre.
Okay. That's the planting part. Take us through the thinning part. What do you need to consider if you are ever thinning a stand that you hope to be poles one day?
So thinning at the proper time to a target basal area is the easiest way to grow the best trees or your pole trees in a stand to final harvest. So you need to consider financial and biological considerations when planning a thinning operation. So usually loggers need about 25 to 28 tons per acre of merchable wood, and trees must be at least 50 feet tall. And then biologically speaking, when the basal area of the stand reaches about 120 square feet per acre, the stand is in need of thinning. And live crown ratio is another important thing you could look for, and it should not dip below about 35 to 40%. Growth response to thinning tends to decrease when individual trees have a lower live crown ratio than that 35 to 40% threshold. Another consideration when pole production is an objective is trees should be taller than about 50 feet and should have self-pruned to a height of about 24 to 32 feet if you're trying to go for higher value poles. But generally, lighter thinnings are good with the first thinning with pole production in mind. Usually a basal area of about 70 to 90 square feet is preferred. And then if you can have the trees professionally marked, to either mark the cut trees or the leave trees, just so there's no question with the loggers on the cut down machine when they're going through the stand.
The
trees you want to target. Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to say the trees you want to target in that first thinning are going to be the ones with defects. And if that still doesn't meet your basal area targets, then you'd want to try to go for the trees in the less dominant crown classes, so your intermediate or suppressed trees. And then oftentimes, if you're trying to grow higher value poles, a second thinning is going to be needed as well.
Okay, so maybe do two thinnings. All right. Well, thank you, David. We appreciate that very much.
Yes, sir.
This is part three and the final part of a series on participating in the carbon offset markets. We've interviewed Matt Smith of Core Carbon, Jonathan Shears with the American Forest Foundation. And today we have Zach Parisa with Silvaterra. Welcome, Zach.
Hey, yeah, great to be with you.
How can landowners engage with these carbon markets and make sure they're getting a fair deal?
Sure. Yeah, you know, it's a really exciting time for landowners, and there are loads of new opportunities to get paid for growing forests longer. And Silvaterra, with the Natural Capital Exchange Program, landowners can get paid for agreeing to defer harvests that they might have otherwise undertaken for just a one-year period. And it's free to enroll in the program, and it opens this Friday for landowners of all sizes. And what's unique with this program is that we're measuring and paying for the volume of carbon that each landowner produces every year, so landowners can know that they're getting a fair deal.
Now, you're talking about a one-year contract. How does that work, and what are the advantages to such a short-term deal?
Yeah, exactly. So after a landowner enrolls on our website, which only takes a couple of minutes and it's completely free, Sylvia Terra assesses their land and sends the landowner an eligibility report. And what's on that report, it shows how much harvest that landowner could potentially defer in that 1 year period. And the landowner can choose the price at which they'd be willing to commit to deferring all or part of their harvest. And so Sylvia Terra actually measures at the start and at the end of that 1 year term with a combination of satellite imagery and a few ground measurements on some of the properties, not all of them. And the landowner's paid for what they actually deliver at the end of that 1 year term. And an important aspect for landowners is that there's no obligation or liability at the end of that 1 year period. The landowners, we do encourage them to continue in the program if it makes sense for them at the end of that term.
Okay. How could a landowner find out about what an offer might be for this 1 year commitment?
Yeah, super easy. So landowners can go to sylviaterra.com. I think there's a link on your website there. And they can enroll in the program for free. There's no obligation there, but they'll get that property-specific eligibility report, like I mentioned, and they can go over that with their forester to determine, if participation is right for them and what price would make sense.
Okay. What could they expect to be paid? What do you think the number is going to wind up being? Does it depend?
Sure. So it definitely differs by ownership. So I'm actually from North Alabama, and so my family has, some acreage of immature, less mature hardwoods, and so it would be less for them, but than it would be for somebody with more mature timber. But landowners can really expect to get about, $10 to $60 per acre for those mature acres that they would have otherwise harvested per year.
Okay. Very good. Well, thank you, Zach. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our
thanks
go to Bart Wilson, Russell Hardy, David Clabo, and Zach Parisa. Have you ever wondered why Thomas Jefferson wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness in the Declaration of Independence, and not the more precise formulation, Life, Liberty, and Property? Was Jefferson contemptuous of property, or was it a political move to satisfy non-property owners? Well, he never felt like he had to explain this because probably he thought everyone understood that the broader concept, the pursuit of happiness, would include the right to own property. Because owning property is the foundation for liberty and security. So it's not July 4th yet, but there's still time to read up on this so that you can have something thoughtful to say on the anniversary of our independence as a nation. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.